for a section entitled Paul and the False Apostles. I hope you'll put up with a little of my foolishness, but you're already doing that. I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promise you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. But I am afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. But I do not think that I am in the least inferior to those super apostles. I may not be a trained speaker, but I do have knowledge. We have made this perfectly clear to you in every way. Was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel of God to you free of charge? I robbed other churches by receiving support from them so as to serve you. And when I was with you and needed something, I was not a burden to anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied what I needed. I have kept myself from being a burden to you in any way and will continue to do so. As surely as the truth of Christ is in me, nobody in the regions of Acacia will stop this boasting of mine. Why? Because I do not love you? God knows I do. And I'll keep on doing what I am doing in order to cut the ground from under those who want an opportunity to be considered equal with us in the things they boast about. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It's not surprising, then, if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness. Their end will be what their actions deserve. Amen.
Well, good morning, everyone. My name's Hugh Thompson. I'm one of the pastors here at City. I see we've quite a few visitors with us this morning. If you're a visitor, let me just explain we're going through the second letter of Paul to the church at Corinth. We've been seeing the sort of troubled relationship that Paul had with the church there, and we've come to this section which Steve has read for us. And I want to start this morning by asking you to imagine something. Imagine you have an 18-year-old daughter. We'll call her Jill. And she's a lovely young Christian, and she's engaged to a nice young Christian man. We'll call him Jack. And Jack and Jill's wedding date is set, and the arrangements are all in place, so that's great. And then Jill starts hanging out with this bloke. And he's not a Christian, although he does go to church from time to time. We'll call him Pete. We'll call him Pagan Pete. And he's an undesirable character. He's handsome, he's attractive, he's plausible, but everybody knows he's a womanizer. Well, you try not to be too heavy-handed about it all. After all, Jill's a sensible girl, isn't she? And it's Jack she's in love with. But then Pagan Pete starts telling Jill, Jack is too straight-laced for you. He's not exciting enough. Actually, he's pretty boring. Why don't you dump him, Pagan Pete says. Why don't you dump him and marry me? We don't have to have a formal wedding. We'll just elope. I'll show you a good time. It'll be great. And then worse. You come home one night and there's Pagan Pete on the sofa with Jill, and he's all over her like a rash. His hands are everywhere. And he's letting her. And all your hopes and plans for Jill and her future with Jack, the whole thing is on the line. You can't let her run off with this gigolo. What are you going to do? Well, you're going to do whatever it takes, aren't you? The gloves are off, no more Mr. Nice Guy. You plead with Jill. You try to get her to see sense, not to be lured away by Pagan Pete. And you've got no hesitation now in just going and pointing out all his faults and all his dodgy morals and all the things you're concerned about in his character. Well, as we come to chapter 11 of 2 Corinthians, that's very much the situation. Paul is the spiritual father of the church in Corinth. It was Paul who brought the gospel to Corinth, first of all. It was Paul who planted the church, founded the church in the city of Corinth. And the church is Christ's church. It's Jesus' church. And the New Testament all over the place describes Jesus as the bridegroom and the church as the bride. And now Paul is desperately worried that the church in Corinth is turning away from Jesus and flirting with something else. And he says, don't be seduced away from Christ. That's the big message. Don't be seduced away from Christ. Paul is like a father waiting for his daughter's wedding day, the day when Jesus returns to claim his bride. And here she is, making eyes at somebody else. Don't be seduced away from Christ. If you look at verse 2, Paul says, I am jealous. I'm jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I guess we usually think of jealousy as a bad thing, as a coveting something that doesn't belong to us. But this is a proper jealousy. This is a right jealousy. This is a jealousy for somebody else. The church belongs to Jesus, and Paul is jealous when someone threatens to make off with her. In the first century Jewish culture, people usually got engaged very young, pretty much as children often. It was an arranged marriage. And the father took the responsibility for the daughter's virginity until the wedding day. That's how it worked. So Paul says, I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. That's not a bad picture of what church leaders are supposed to be doing, striving to present their people to Christ as a pure virgin. It's also the responsibility of each and every one of us in the church. Elsewhere, Paul talked to the Colossians. He said, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom. That's our responsibility. That's our common purpose at City Church, is to be presenting each other, to be teaching and admonishing and rebuking each other so that we are pure as a virgin bride for Christ. And now Paul sees here others trying to muscle in on this relationship and to take the place of the bridegroom, take the place of Jesus. And he says, don't be seduced away from Christ. Don't. So verse 3, I'm afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. Paul compares those who mislead Christians about Christ to Satan in the Garden of Eden, misleading Adam and Eve. He says it's not an accident, it's deliberate. It's done by cunning, he says. It's just like the fall. It couldn't be more serious. Listen to how seriously Jesus takes this. He said to his disciples, whoever welcomes a little child in my name welcomes me. But if anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a large millstone hung round his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. See how serious it is? And Paul says their minds are being led astray. It literally means their minds are being corrupted or destroyed. Paul fears that the Corinthians' thinking is being ruined by what these people are doing. So who are these people who are seducing the Corinthian Christians away from Jesus? Well, in verse 5, Paul calls them super apostles. Super apostles. It's sarcasm. We're going to see as we go on, these people weren't apostles at all, far less super apostles. And here's Paul's warning about the super apostles. What are they up to? Verse 4, they come and preach a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached. You receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted. Some people say that these super apostles were Judaizers. They were trying to convince the early church that you needed to follow the Old Testament law to be right with God, and there may be truth in that. But probably it's more subtle than that. And if it's more subtle than that, it's more dangerous than that. They're talking about using Christianity to look impressive and be successful. We know that from Paul's first letter to the Corinthians and from some of the other things he said in 2 Corinthians. They want Christianity to be something that brings them status. At the end of the 19th century, the valley of Kaiser Wilhelm, who was the German emperor, said this about his master, the emperor. He said, I cannot deny that my master is vain. He always wants to be the center of attention. When he goes to a wedding, he wants to be the bride. When he goes to a baptism, he wants to be the baby. When he goes to a funeral, he wants to be the corpse. Well, the super apostles are a bit like that. There's no place for humility in their theology. There's no place for servanthood in their theology. They want to be noticed. They want to have status. And in verse 4, Paul says they're preaching a different Jesus, a different spirit, and a different gospel. A different Jesus, getting away from the humble Jesus who came not to be served, but to serve. A different spirit. Not a spirit that produces love and joy and peace and patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. A spirit of pride. A spirit of boastfulness. A jostling for position and status. A different gospel, emphasizing strength rather than weakness, playing down the cross and playing up the glory in the Christian life. What the super apostles really are wanting is a Christianity without the cross. That's what it boils down to. A crossless Christianity. Now, how attractive that can be. How seductive, how flattering. That's exactly what Jesus was tempted to do by Satan in the desert after his baptism. Satan came and said to him, remember, tell these stones to become bread. You can win people by producing a limitless supply of food. You don't have to go to the cross, Jesus. Throw yourself down from the temple. Do mighty miracles. Everyone will believe in you then. You don't have to go to the cross. Bow down and worship me, and I will give you all the kingdoms of the world, lied Satan. You don't have to go to the cross. It's Christianity without the cross. And let's be quite honest, it's quite appealing in some ways, isn't it? Isn't it? It's quite seductive. We're not immune from modern day super apostles, a different Jesus, a different spirit. A different gospel? The true Jesus suffered horribly on the cross. The true Spirit groans with a suffering world. The true gospel is a message about a crucified Savior. And most of the false teachers around us, and most of the cults and the sects and the distortions of the Christian faith, they are trying to escape that. It's so tempting to water down the gospel message and take out the bits that we think or feel might offend people. The bits about our sin, the bits about God's wrath, the bits about judgment and hell, that's going to upset people. the humiliating truth that we can't make ourselves right with God. That's going to put people right off. So easy to disembowel the gospel in such a way that the cross becomes completely unnecessary. And it's going on all around us in our country. The history of the church in the Western world in the 20th century shows where that leads to. The more preachers tried to make the gospel attractive and inoffensive, the more they tried to attract people to church by leaving out the stuff that they thought might be unpalatable, the more they tried to make Christianity easy and popular, the emptier the churches became. Back in 1941, Martin Lloyd-Jones, who was then the minister at Westminster Chapel in London, he preached at St. Mary's Church in Oxford during the Oxford University mission. And he preached there as he would have preached anywhere else. And then he made arrangements to answer questions in a hall afterwards. And the hall was packed out. And the vicar took the chair, and then the time came when questions were asked for, and immediately this young man jumped up, and he complimented the speaker, and then he said there was something he couldn't understand. He really couldn't see, he said, that the sermon might not just as well have been preached to a congregation of farm labourers or anyone else, and the whole crowd roared with laughter. Well, Martin Lloyd-Jones got up and he said he couldn't see the questioner's difficulty because he had to admit that until that moment he had regarded undergraduates and indeed graduates of Oxford University as just ordinary human clay and miserable sinners like everyone else. And he held the view that their needs were precisely the same as those of an agricultural labourer or anyone else. And he said he'd preach as he had done quite deliberately. And that's what had upset the intellectual elite. They were insulted. They didn't want to be told they were sinners. They didn't want to be told they were weak. They wanted to be strong and impressive and have people look up to them, just like the Corinthian super apostles. Now, I don't know how you feel. It's quite a temptation, isn't it? Most of us here are relatively well off and well educated and in jobs. Are we prepared to look weak, to be foolish in the eyes of the world? Or do we just adjust things a bit so that people don't look down on us too much as Christians? Paul's appalled that the Corinthian Christians are falling for this sort of thing. Someone comes and preaches a different Jesus and a different spirit and a different gospel. And Paul says, it's the end of verse 4, you put up with it easily. Like Jill on the sofa, allowing pagan Pete to touch her up. How quickly people can turn away from Paul and the true gospel. How easily we can be persuaded to look down on weakness, like the super apostles, like they look down on Paul. And Paul's going on to defend himself. Verse 5, I do not think, he says, that I am in the least inferior to these super apostles. And Paul's going to do what he would normally call foolish by boasting about his own credentials. That's why he says in verse 1, I hope you'll put up with a little of my foolishness. Normally, Paul wouldn't enter into this sort of boasting, not into these sort of debates with the super apostles, but he's been driven to it out of his burning concern for the Christians in the church in Corinth. Paul needs to demonstrate that he is the true apostle, and that the gospel he is preaching is the true gospel. So he says, I hope you will put up with a little of my foolishness. And then rather bitterly, he says, but you're doing that already. You've already been persuaded by the super apostles to look down on me, to look on me as a fool. Well, Paul's boasting about his credentials as an apostle starts down in verse 16 of this chapter. And if you want to know what he says, you'll have to come back next Sunday morning. We're going to look at that then. But before we get there, Paul has some warnings for the Corinthian Christians. So he said, don't be seduced away from Christ. Secondly, he says, don't be gullible. Don't be gullible. Don't be a pushover for these false teachers. Don't be naive. I think we as Christians can be very naive sometimes. G.K. Chesterton once wrote, when people abandon the truth, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. Don't be mugs, says Paul. Don't dump the truth for something more attractive and more exciting and more trendy and more comfortable and less threatening. Don't do it. Don't be gullible. Don't be impressed by slick performance, says Paul. Look at verse 6. I may not be a trained speaker, he says, but I do have knowledge. Paul's unimpressive as an orator. We know that from the scriptures. Paul knows that himself. Back a page in the Bibles in chapter 10, he's already said, some say about him, his letters are weighty and forceful, but in person he is unimpressive and his speaking amounts to nothing. Probably very different from the super apostles. Almost certainly, they were following the sort of contemporary Greek style of oratory. The Greek orators would tour around from region to region, and they'd deliver impressive and lengthy speeches about whatever people wanted them to, for loads of money. And they bragged that they could speak on any subject straight off without any notice. And you had to admire them. Amazing. Don't know if you ever listened to the panel game Just a Minute on Radio 4. Did you listen to that? I think it's great. Anyway, the contestants have to speak for one minute without hesitation, deviation, or repetition. Well, these Greek orators could have pulled it off every time. But not Paul. Paul couldn't. Listen to what he wrote in 1 Corinthians, his first letter to the Corinthians. When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to do nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. So here's Paul in Corinth. And he gets up the first day he's there and he preaches the cross. And then the next day in the marketplace he gets up and he preaches the cross again. And then the third day he gets up and he preaches the cross. And the same thing again and again. He's guilty of repetition every time. Not like the super apostles. They're Greek orators. They have a smooth patter. They change their subject every day. Paul says, don't be impressed by slick performance. Be discerning. Ask, who is it who has the truth? Not how well can they talk? So he says, I may not be a trained speaker, but I have knowledge. He has the truth. Paul is seen as an amateur by the Corinthians. Is that a problem for you? It was a problem for the Corinthians. It's easy to be impressed by good speakers. I am easily impressed by good orators. I'm easily persuaded. I have to listen very carefully if someone's a good speaker. I find myself just going along with what they say because they say it well. Think of Barack Obama. It's great to listen to Barack Obama. It's fantastic. I don't really know what he said. Not very much. Much worse, think of Hitler. He persuaded hundreds of thousands of people to go along with his terrible wickedness by great oratory. Paul says, don't be impressed by slick presentations. I guess it's not just about preaching, it's about other things in churches, things in our services. Some people are disappointed that City Church is not more of a rock concert, or there isn't more flashy technology in our services. Well, I tell you, just don't be impressed by that sort of thing. Don't be impressed by slick presentation. Secondly, Paul says, don't be taken in by material success. Don't be taken in by material success. Look at verse 7. Was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel to you free of charge? It seems the Corinthians think Paul is cheap. Maybe he doesn't charge for his evangelism because he's not good enough. I think we value what we pay for, don't we? We value what we pay for. If something costs you nothing, then you don't value it very highly, I suspect. If it costs you nothing, you're suspicious about it. There's no such thing as a free lunch. I don't know if you get these letters I get through the letterbox from time to time. Mr. Thompson, you have won a valuable free gift. You have won. Isn't that great? And I immediately look at the small print to see what the catch is, because there always is a catch, isn't there? Well, the Corinthians are here, and they're saying the super apostles are a going concern. They're successful. They cover their own expenses. Not like this fellow Paul, who has to go crawling to other churches to pay for him. Verse 8. I robbed other churches, says Paul, by receiving support from them so as to serve you. And when I was with you and needed something, I was not a burden to anyone, for the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied what I need. And the Corinthians are saying, we don't want to be seen receiving charity. What an insult. Paul has been working as a tent maker. And in that society, only slaves did manual work. So clearly, Paul's a failure. In fact, he's a complete embarrassment. A number of years ago, I worked in a hospital in Hong Kong. And I was shocked to discover something. I was shocked to discover that if you come out of medical school in Hong Kong, and they have a very excellent medical school in Hong Kong, they've got two actually, if you come out of medical school and you want to set up as a general practitioner in Hong Kong, no matter how good a doctor you are, you must borrow money and buy a Rolls Royce. You must. Because if you don't, you're not a success. And you can't be a good doctor, and you won't get any patients, and you'll go bust. It's the truth. Now, that's how the Corinthians are thinking. And Paul says, don't be so gullible. Don't be taken in by material success. And you know, increasingly, we see the prosperity gospel preached. In countries in West Africa, in America, and increasingly in Britain, more and more so. Christians, you Christians are children of the King, they say. God has made his people wonderful promises. Don't you settle for anything less than a triumphant Christian life. It's your right. Well, it's true that God has promised us glory and made us all sorts of wonderful promises. But the Bible calls us to follow the pattern of Jesus, which is suffering now, glory later. Suffering now, glory later. In this world, we are called to take up our cross. The prosperity gospel says that as a Christian, you should be healthy and wealthy and popular and successful now. And if you aren't, there's something wrong with you as a Christian. Your faith is wobbly, or you're not praying properly. The problem you see with the prosperity gospelers is that they have no theology of suffering. They get on quite well until things become hard. And the Christian life does get hard for everyone. And then they become disillusioned. and they feel God has let them down. Well, I suspect that the super apostles are preaching a prosperity gospel on some farm in Corinth. And we just need to recognize that and run a mile from it. It's so attractive. The real heroes in the faith are not the tele-evangelists in their mega churches with their thousands in their congregations and loads of money. The real heroes of the faith are Christians who are standing faithfully for Jesus in the face of persecution and a disadvantage and suffering in various parts of the world. And what an insult if we tell them that their faith is deficient because that's what they're going through. What a disgrace. Well, now, Paul gets to the root of the issue. He says these spiritual seducers, these slick performers, these prosperity gospelers, these pagan Petes of the first century, he says they're not apostles at all, far less super apostles. Verse 13, such men, he says, are false apostles, deceitful workmen masquerading as apostles of Christ. So all of this isn't about variations between Christians in style of worship or differences between different denominations about baptism or spiritual gifts or something like this. This is about persuading people not to go the way of the cross. And those leading the Corinthian church astray, Paul says, are servants of Satan. Verse 14, Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It is not surprising, then, if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness. And Paul says, don't be fooled by Satan's disguises. Don't be fooled by Satan's disguises. The devil is never more pleased than when we fail to discern what he's up to. Error is always presented in an attractive light. False teachers don't come and stand at the door of the church at the end of the service with a big notice round their neck saying, I'm a heretic. They sit in the congregation and smile, and they're plausible, and they're very nice and persuasive. And this is all about deceit. The serpent deceived Eve in the Garden of Eden. Paul's referred to that back in verse 3. Jesus calls the devil the liar and father of lies. Watch out for false prophets, said Jesus. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ferocious wolves. Listen to Paul writing or speaking to the church in Ephesus when he left them, speaking to the elders there. He said, he warned them, I know that after I leave, savage wolves will come in among you and will not spare the flock. Even from among your own number, men will arise and distort the truth in order to draw away disciples after them. So be on your guard, says Paul. Be on your guard. Now, many of you, like me, can think of Christian leaders who would call themselves evangelicals and have started to persuade people away from the cross. Someone has written a book describing the cross as cosmic child abuse. He's entertaining. He's a very good speaker, conference speaker, very plausible, and he's very dangerous. And Paul would describe him as a servant of Satan. Well, thank God that in 10 years at City Church, we've enjoyed wonderful unity and very few attempts at false teaching. A few, but very few. Let's be on our guard. That doesn't mean always looking for trouble. That doesn't mean pouncing on everybody whose views are different about anything or everything. It does mean determining to follow Jesus in the way of the cross and resisting every attempt to turn us aside, to seduce us away from the cross. We mustn't be gullible. Don't be impressed by slick performance. Don't be taken in by material success, and don't be fooled by Satan's disguises. If we see Christians being drawn away to another Jesus or another spirit or another gospel, we need to recognize it as Satan's work and resist it tooth and nail. What father would stand by and watch his virgin daughter being seduced? That's how seriously Paul puts it. So let's be jealous for one another's walk with the Lord in the way that Paul was jealous. I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. Let's be jealous for one another with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband to Christ that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. My prayer is that each one of us would be striving to present each other as a pure virgin to Christ in the last day. Let's pray now. Let's just take a moment of silence to think about these very serious things, and then I'll pray. Heavenly Father, forgive us when we want to make Christianity easy and comfortable. Forgive us that even as we read a passage like this, we sort of wish we were looking at something else because we don't want to deal with these sorts of things. Forgive us when we bend to those who want us to move the cross out of the center of our faith, even just a little bit. Father, help us to recognize that we are only in your kingdom, only your children, because of the cross. Help us to remember Jesus' instruction to deny ourselves and take up our cross day by day. And Father, help us to love each other enough to be prepared to address these hard things and to correct each other and encourage each other in the right way. Help us not just to be papering over cracks so that we have a nice time together. Help us to be jealous for our standing before you in our purity as the bride for your Son on that last day, for his glory. Amen.
One of the ways we can really help